Psalm 27 then. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is a stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? What wonderful words. What a great statement of hope and confidence from David. In the face of clearly difficulties and troubles, this great statement of trust and hope, certainty, confidence, is our opening. In common with Psalm 26 that we looked at last time and Psalm 28, which, well, guess when we're going to look at that. This is a psalm that I think there are three that express very similar sentiments. The Lord's protection, confidence in God. In the face of conflict, enemies, trouble. The joy that comes from worshipping in the presence of God. And David's trust in God. And where perhaps Psalm 26 and Psalm 28 to a certain extent are perhaps a little bit more measured, more restrained, Psalm 27 seems to be a much more exuberant, much more expressive psalm by comparison. We don't know much about when it was written. Clearly it's a time when David is in trouble, when an army besieges him, my heart won't fear. If war's broken out against me, my enemies and my foes attack me. Okay, it's a time of trouble for David. Some people would say on the basis of verse 10, though my father and mother forsake me, the Lord will receive me. Maybe he's thinking there about the events in 1 Samuel 22. He's on the run from Saul again, and he takes his parents up to the king of Moab, and he says, "Look, would you look after them for me?" And he's let my father and mother come and stay with you until I learn what God will do for me. So he left them with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him as long as David was in the stronghold. Maybe that is the instance that David is thinking of. Here as he writes this, maybe it isn't. I wouldn't want to be dogmatic about that. I do know I can tell you the huge encouragement that this verse, thinking of a man I know in Uganda, an orphan, and the way a verse like that, even though my father and mother forsake me, the Lord will receive me. A boy had been kind of abandoned, his father in prison and all sorts of horrible stuff. And to be able to cling on to God in that way. Some of you have great relationships with your father, happy memories of your relationship with your father, and other people don't. When they think of their father, it's a painful thing or a difficult thing, or they just feel the grief, the loss. Well, for those of us, whatever our relationship with our father, he is a father who never disappoints, will never reject or forsake or let down. Maybe that's the setting. And just like last time we said that there's a way in which David would sing it, there's a way in which we would sing it. And when we sing it, when we sing of deliverance and God's rescue, we're not thinking about being saved from the king and his armies, probably. But when we sing of deliverance, we see Jesus, don't we? We see what he's done on our behalf. And when we sing of a shelter, a hiding place, well, we are thinking of the work of Jesus on behalf. And in verse 9, do not hide your face from me, Lord, from me. Do not turn your servant away in anger. You've become my helper. Do not reject me or forsake me, O God, my Savior. We can't help but be reminded of Jesus' cry from the cross, where he is conscious of the Father's, what? Forsaking of him, turning away. Jesus cut off so that you never would need to be. Last week, I mentioned this idea of chiasm, the way this is arranged as a kind of mirror, and how the emphasis ought to hang where the text puts the emphasis. And the middle point of this, you could go away and compare it and look at it, is verse 7. No, it's not, it's verse 8, sorry. My heart says of you, seek his face, your face, Lord, I will seek. The desire to see God. The desire to be face to face with God. And the bits around it, I think they're kind of meant to instruct us in how it is we seek God's face. So for those of you who like titles, I don't always come up with snappy titles for sermons, but here's a title. It's what David says. It's in verse 8. Your face, Lord, I will seek. That's what we're about. That ought to be what we're about. It's what you came for this evening. It should be what you came here for this evening. But to kind of fill in, how is it that we're to seek God's face? Well, David tells us, teach me your way, O Lord. He says that in verse 11. He wants God to lead him and teach him. And I think that's mirrored in verse 4, where, what is it like to seek God's face? What does it feel like? What does it look like? One thing I ask of the Lord, this is what I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to seek him in his temple. That's where David wants to dwell. Well, I want us to dwell on this verse now for a little while. Teach me your way, he says to David, and we want God to teach us. Is it right that we learn of God? It's why the Bible is important. What we call theology is important. Theology is what we know about God. And the Bible is absolutely at the center of what we do. Well, I hope that's pretty obvious. We meet together for about an hour, about half of which, so more than anything else, is spent examining this, talking about it, isn't it? So it's our central emphasis, learning of God. And maybe you sometimes think, well, you know, I just want to worship. I don't want all this kind of teaching, this theology stuff. Well, theology is who God is. Theology is us knowing what he is like. How can you worship him if you don't know who he is? How could you worship him if you don't know what he is like? You wouldn't then be worshipping God. You'd be worshipping an idol that you had made up yourself. We can't worship God properly without knowing him, without knowing what he's like, without understanding him. True. But that's not enough. You see, as well as understanding, as well as knowing, there has to be an involvement of the affections, of the heart, and the will, and what we feel and what we do. Not enough just of a head full of knowledge about God, but that would sink into us and shape us. As I say, shape our affections, what we feel and what we do, our will and our heart. And what David says, well, here's a question for you. Why does David come to the temple? Why does he come to the temple? Verse 4. You see, there's lots of reasons you could go think of the temple. You know a bit about the temple, don't you? He's covered in gold. I mean, we've got white emulsion here, but that's covered in gold. And that's got all this kind of the music and the singing that goes with it. Well, the Bible describes in temple worship a whole bunch of different instruments. We've got a keyboard and mark for which we're very grateful. We've got your voices gathered together, but you're not the hundreds, maybe thousands that would cram around the temple. We haven't got all the kind of, well, no sacrifices, no incense. I don't get those great priestly robes with the precious stones embedded in the front and the great hat. None of it. I mean, you can understand if somebody goes up to the temple, how that would be entertaining. Regardless of whether or not you were a worshipper of God, you could imagine how, well, going up to the temple might be, well, it's a good day out, isn't it? And of all the reasons you could come, the wonderful architecture and the beauty of it, the crowds, the music, the ritual, the sacrifice, the teaching, the sense of history about the place, plenty to entertain, but that's not what David wants, is it? Why is it he comes? What is it that he wants? Not to be entertained, but to behold God. Not to be entertained, but to behold God. This is what I want, he says. To dwell in the house of the Lord, to be where God is, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord, to seek him in his temple. And in verse 8, my heart says, seek his face, your face, Lord, I will seek. This is what he goes up for. Now, we don't have a temple here. We have a lovely 150-year-old chapel. So we maybe haven't come for those entertainments. But have we come to seek God's face? Have we come to behold him? Now notice what he says in verse 4. There's a test he lays out for us here. It's a kind of diagnostic thing. You know, it's like the car is making a funny noise. It's rumbling away to itself. And so you go to the garage and they take the car and they plug it into the computer and it runs these magic things that tells it on the screen what's wrong with your engine. It's diagnostic. It tests it. Well, here's the diagnostic test for you. Not a machine I'm going to plug you in, but a question that David says. There's one thing, David says, that I want. It is a singular desire. It is a desire above all others. Whatever else David wants, whatever else David loves, one thing. The one thing David wants, is to dwell in the house of the Lord and to gaze on the beauty of the Lord. So, here's the question to you. Your singular desire, the one thing, you can't have anything else. The rest of it goes. Friend, the rest of it is going anyway. David, I think, used to enjoy playing cricket when he was a young man. I don't suppose he plays much cricket anymore. I love to ride my bike. I won't always be able to ride my bike. Some of you can think about the things you used to be able to do. The way you used to play with your grandchildren. And you can't. And those things you enjoyed, they're passing. They're going. Your bank account, however impressive it is passing and fading and won't last. But David says, there's one thing I want. The singular desire, the one thing he really wants. When all the other things have gone, and they will, friend, go, what is the one thing that you really want? And you notice the language he uses. He says it. This is what I seek. This week, again, I lost my keys. When I lose my keys, which I do with frustrating regularity, I don't just have a look for them. I seek for them. I search for them. I turn the house upside down. I was going to say until I find them. No, until my wife finds them tucked away on the wrong shelf or something that I'd put them there without thinking. But there you go. You see, I seek. There's an intensity about that word, isn't there? It's not a casual glance. David wants to seek. He wants to dwell. He wants to gaze. Now, those words involve, they imply a sense of activity and a lasting thing. It's not a quick flash in the pan to gaze on something, not a glance, to dwell somewhere, not just a pass through, to seek something. This is his singular desire. To come to seek God's face, to see God. Is that your singular desire? You don't have a temple. We have a church. I don't mean this building. I mean the gathered body of Christ as they meet together, the people of God. And when we meet, we sing together and we read together. The word is preached, and we have ordinances, Lord's Supper, that we celebrate together. We have ordinance of baptism that we observe together. What are these things for? What's the point of them? Is it just so that, you know, when you come along each week, you know what's going to happen? There's nothing to catch you out. You don't want to feel too uncomfortable after all. No, why do we always do these things? Because these are the things that God has given us to do. These are the things that, it wasn't my idea that we structured our service around those things. It wasn't Mark's idea before him. Or other people way back in church history. It's God's instruction that those are the elements as we gather together. They are the channels by which he intends to bless his people. God has put them in place. If we neglect the channels that he has given, the means by which he intends to bless us, well, we're going to fall short, aren't we? We're going to miss out on his intention for us. You know, and you'll come across people sometimes and they'll tell you that they're a Christian. But you discover they actually never go to church. And I don't mean somebody who's like long-term and well and would love to be able to, but just for various constraints and reasons they're not able to. I'm talking about somebody who just doesn't really want to be there. A Christian who doesn't go to church, it's kind of like, it's like being on a starvation diet for your soul. You know, there's pictures and you've seen them, haven't you, of the suffering in when people have famines. And there they are on the telly and the flies are buzzing around them and the aid trucks are coming in and these pitifully small bags of flour among so many. And what will they do? And people are sitting under a bush and they've got this... And a desperate situation. You see these people and the hopelessness about it. And they're wasting away. And there's nothing to them. And if we deprive ourselves of the means that God intends to bless us, spiritually we're doing the same thing, but not being forced on us because it has happened, but rather we're doing it to ourselves. We're starving ourselves to a point of weakness. You see, David knows that the place to seek God's face is to come to the house of the Lord. Again, not a pile of bricks, but the place where God is, the place where he reveals himself. But as the psalmist comes, as David comes, as he seeks, as he looks, now this is interesting, isn't it? Look at what it is he wants. He wants, last part of verse 4, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord. To gaze upon the beauty of the Lord. Can I introduce you to an old man? His name's Jonathan Edwards. He lived in the 18th century. He was born in 1703. And a man, well, we sometimes sort of create a kind of dichotomy, a tension between perhaps a study and theology and devoting yourself to knowing about God and knowing his word and studying it and the kind of element of devotion and joy and we create this false tension that puts one there and the other there. And Jonathan Edwards is a man who brings those two together. He has a lifelong habit of rising at 4 in the morning and studies for 13 hours every day. He has a brain the size of a small planet. He is the greatest American theologian there's ever been. He was appointed the president of Princeton University. A mighty intellect. But not just this serious intellectual rigor, but a deep, a spiritual devotion. He had a deep encounter with God when he was aged 17. He describes it in this way. That holiness appeared to me of a sweet, pleasant, charming, serene, calm nature. And it brought an inexpressible purity, brightness, peacefulness, and ravishment to the soul. That kind of delight over holiness. And he describes it as being like this. It's, if you could imagine, the soul of a true Christian, I wrote in my meditations, appeared like a little white flower that we see in the spring. It's low, it's humble on the ground, but it opens its bosom to receive the pleasant beams of the sun's glory. Think about a daisy as it opens up to receive the sunshine. And that, he says, is how a Christian responds to God. My heart panted after this, to lie low before God as in the dust, that I might be nothing and that God might be all, that I might become as a little child. I think he's describing the same thing that David is describing. My heart panted after this, says Jonathan Edwards, that I would become nothing, but that God would be everything. He was a minister in a congregational church, in fact, in Massachusetts. And he saw an incredible work of revival in his own parish in the 1730s. And then later on, when the Great Awakening came to America, he wrote two important books. Here's one, here's a freebie, if you would read it. It's called The Distinguishing Marks of a Work of the Holy of the Spirit of God. Actually, it's an abridgment, but it encourages us to examine, when we say God is doing something, what are the tests? What is the evidence that God's really doing something? First person to catch me afterwards, if you'll read it, take it away. I've got two. But he's got another work, it's called this, it's called A Treatise on the Religious Affections. You see, great titles they could give to books back then. Nobody would buy it today, would they? But there you go. Religious affections. The attitude of heart and will towards God. And he says, and I'm going to paraphrase because it's quite, the language doesn't trip off the tongue very easily, but basically what he says lists, that real affection that comes from God, real love towards God, real evidence of God being at work, is that we love God for his own sake and not for self-interest. We love God for his own sake and not for self-interest. That's the challenge that Jonathan Edwards lays before us. Do you love God for who he is in himself? Because often we talk about what God has done. We talk about his holiness and our sin and how we are rightly under his judgment and cut off from him and deserving of judgment. And we talk about he in his love and his grace had a plan of salvation whereby God the Son became flesh, was born just like you were, lived, died on a cross in order to rescue us from sin. Was raised again, ascended into heaven, will one day return. We call that the gospel, the good news. That is good news. Now, if you were a Christian, as I tell you those things ought to stir you. They ought to make you cry towards him with love. But you see this, they are things he's done. They're not who he is. Now, the things that someone has done, tell us a bit about them. Give us an insight into their character. But they're what they've done, not who they are. Here's an example. What if I started telling you about how I love my wife, Rosie? She's not here, so I can do this without her throwing a hymn book at me. It's okay. And I could start telling you how, oh, she's wonderful. You know, she cooks me my tea. Do you know our house? She's brilliant with a Hoover. If someone's coming to our house, she'll have been round with a Hoover before you get there, and it will, the carpet will be lovely. And the shirt, she ironed it. And our boys, you want to see the way she loves them and she takes care of them and looks after them. And I can give you a long list of all the things she does and say, well, that's why I love her. And probably quite rightly, she would throw that hymn book at me, wouldn't she? Because you see, those are all things she has done. They are not who she is. They are not her character. But if I told you that she was gracious and kind and gentle, then I would be giving you reasons to love her because of who she is, not because of what she does for me. Do you see the difference? And so often, we begin to think about God in terms of what he does for us, rather than who he is. And here's a challenge, isn't it? Can we love God not for what he does, but for who he is? And the challenge not to want what God can give us, but to want God himself. No, can there be anything? You as a human being, all 5'10" of you. You as a human being with all your aches and pains. You are able to be face to face with God. You're able to gaze on him, to behold his beauty. Now, of all the other things you might achieve, and I know you, some of your accomplishments are remarkable, but of all the things you can achieve, none of them can come close to that, can it? That God has made you that you can know him, that you could see him, that you could gaze on him. Not to have what he can give, but to have God himself. Look, let me ask you a question as we close. What effect would this have? If you spent this time with God, if like David, you said, I will seek his face. I think if we spent our time gazing on him, I think if we devoted ourselves to him for who he is, I think if we were increasingly determined to spend a time in his presence, I think we'd be changed. I think we would increasingly be holy, increasingly sanctified, increasingly becoming what he would have us to be. Now, this isn't some mystical thing. This isn't go and sit on top of a pole somewhere in the desert and chant away to yourself for hours. As I said before, there are means by which God reveals himself. There are channels of divine blessing that he's put in place. Gathering together of the church. Of the ordinances of the church. Prayer. The reading of the Bible. But I think we'd be changed by these things. And as I say, the focus on him for who he is. Diagnostic test David lays before us. This is the one thing David's going to ask of the Lord. You get one request. This is David's. Would you make it yours? Your face, Lord, I will seek.